Anybody over the age of 35 has memories of when there was a Soviet Union and a Cold War between that country and the United States. From the wreckage of the USSR, we got the rebirth of Russia, a shiny new baby full of possibilities. The kid has disappointed much of the world, becoming a cantankerous, belligerent adolescent with an autocratic leader in President Vladimir Putin. Arkady Ostrovsky tells us how we got here in his book, The Invention of Russia, From Gorbachev's Freedom to Putin's War. Arkady Ostrovsky is a Russian-born journalist. He left Russia to study English literature in England as his country opened up. He returned as a foreign correspondent, first for the Financial Times, now for The Economist. Arkady is a regular commentator on Russia and the USSR on NPR and BBC. 3 weeks ago, The Invention of Russia won the Orwell Prize for Best Political Writing in England in book form. Arkady Ostrovsky, congratulations and welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you this morning.
You begin with the murder of Boris Nemtsov. Who was he and why is his killing in particular so significant, or at least symbolic?
Well, there are several answers to that question. Boris Nemtsov was a great liberal politician in Russia. He was at one point a presidential hopeful picked by Boris Yeltsin. He was a true Democrat. He was, in a way, he sort of embodied the hopes and the possibilities of Russia's transition to freedom in the late 1980s, 1990s. He served as a governor of Nizhny Novgorod, the city which was infamous for serving as an exile place for a great Russian physicist and dissident, Andrei Sakharov. Boris Nemtsov was then deputy prime minister. He was also a very close contact and a friend for me. And I was finishing the book. I was literally sending my last corrections to the publisher when I've learned of his death, of his murder, just outside the Kremlin. And in a way, that was, to me, sort of the full stop, the line in this story, which I tried to describe, the very tragic line that Russia had crossed, where human life had once again become meaningless, and where a week before this murder, I watched people carrying huge portraits of Boris Nemtsov, accusing him of being a traitor, blaming him for, alleging that he was an agent of foreign powers, that he was part of the Fifth Column. It was almost like watching some footage from the 1930s Germany. It was a really an alarming moment, and as I said, a week later, Nemtsov was murdered. So it kind of brought that story to a very tragic point.
Well, you know what? The term great liberal politician is not one you hear often in Russia. I mean, are they really an endangered species there?
They are. And the story of Nemtsov captures that very well. Now, they're endangered species now physically because they represent a different Russia, and they still represent that Russia which emerged from the rubble of the Soviet Union in the early 90s. They are evidence for Putin that, and for a lot of people, that Russia could have developed in a different way. They also were endangered species, endangered by the actions of those who were in power, or at least who commanded the media in the 1990s. Boris Nemtsov became a deputy prime minister, as I said, in 1997, after Boris Yeltsin was re-elected as Russia's president. Russia was still a free and democratic, relatively democratic country. Nemtsov was the man that Yeltsin introduced to Bill Clinton and to Thatcher and to leaders around the world as Russia's potential next president. And guess what? He's been brought down, and his government had been brought down, not by some KGB coup or a plot, not by Vladimir Putin. Boris Nemtsov was brought, you know, and he had a rating of something like 70%. You know, he was Russia's Bill Clinton, if you like. And he was brought down not by some dark force. He was brought down by those who control the media, the oligarchs, those who thought of themselves as westernizers, as liberals, who used their control over television to fight corporate wars with one another, and who in the process completely discredited the idea of democracy, of liberalism, of westernism, to the degree that Yeltsin had little choice in 1999 but to look among security services entourage for his successor.
And that's when he looked at Vladimir Putin?
Yes, it was. That was the time when he looked at Vladimir Putin. I mean, Putin's emergence as Russia's president is a story in its own, because what happened was in 1996, as I said, Yeltsin got reelected as Russia's president. He was incredibly ill. He suffered several heart attacks. The question of succession became very poignant and important almost straight away. Now, with the idea of liberal democracy and Westernism being discredited by those who had political and economic power in Russia in the 1990s, the oligarchs like Boris Berezovsky and partly Vladimir Gusinsky, and the financial crisis in 1998, Yeltsin started to look for a successor amongst the security services.
Now, right, which Yeltsin's is where Yeltsin, family, we need to take a break here. Arkady Ostrovsky is our guest on The Exchange. His book is The Invention of Russia. Back on The Exchange with our guest and your phone calls and emails in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Russian-born journalist Arkady Ostrovsky. His book is The Invention of Russia, From Gorbachev's Freedom to Putin's War. It shows us how we got from the great hopes of the post-Soviet return of the Russian Republic, an independent Russian Republic, and got to where we are today with Vladimir Putin, militaristic, kleptocratic, autocratic, you name it. A lot of things going on in Russia today that we wouldn't have anticipated 20 or 25 years ago. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Arkady, you were saying that Boris Yeltsin had to look among the security services for a successor when his term as president was running out. But were there options as notable as Putin available to him?
Yeah, I mean that's where the story really starts getting very intriguing, because what happened was after the crisis, the financial crisis of 98, when Russia became effectively toxic for investors and Russian people lost their savings yet again, you had to appoint a man by the name of Yevgeny Primakov, who was an old Cold War type. Former spy and head of the foreign intelligence services, as prime minister and potential successor. Yeltsin didn't like the man, but had to do that to pacify and placate the protests. And what happened after that is the oligarchs, who, as I said, controlled the media, thought of a plan. The plan was, why don't we create our own security man, our own obedient guy who will kind of look like a security man, but will listen to us, will be loyal to Yeltsin, will be loyal to his family, and will ensure the sort of peaceful transition of power and will ensure that the oligarch's wealth stays with them. And they came out with a few names, one of whom was Vladimir Putin. They were all kind of nondiscreet, mediocre, kind of almost non-entities. And yet, Yeltsin picked out Putin. The media rallied behind this completely unknown man. You might remember that famous question, and I think the CNN said, you know, who's Mr. Putin? Nobody knew who Mr. Putin was. And the media decided that it could perform this miracle. It can create, sort of turn Putin into president, even though nobody's heard of him. You know, a few weeks of heavy sort of television bombardment, just as they'd done in 96 in Yeltsin's re-election, would bring Putin to power. Now, the difference was that Yeltsin was a historical figure of great stature, you know, of extraordinary historical scale. So even if the media was biased, they were working with a real man, you know, with a real real politician. With Putin, they were completely constructing a politician out of somebody who'd never had any political career. And yet they succeeded. Perhaps Yeltsin, with hindsight, perhaps Yeltsin saw something more in Putin than we did at the time. Perhaps Yeltsin had sensed sort of Putin's instinct for power and his political, sort of hidden political acumen, because, you know, Putin has ruled Russia for now 16 years, four of which he served as prime minister, but he retained power in a very complicated place. He remains popular. So perhaps Yeltsin, who himself had this extraordinary sort of animal-like instinct for power, discern something in Putin that is now becoming more apparent to the rest of the world. Although Yeltsin did think that choosing Putin as a successor was one of his greatest mistakes of political life.
Arkady Ostrovsky is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The Invention of Russia is his book. You say in the book, Russia is an idea-centric country and the media play a disproportionately important role. Can you tease that out for us?
Yeah. Russia is a country where words and ideas always carried a great deal of importance. You know, we know Russia for its literature. I was lucky to translate Tom Stoppard's Coast of Utopia, a play about Russian 19th century thinkers in Russia, and one of them says, you know, Russia will be known for its literature. Russia, you know, literature will become Russia. You know, there was another remark which was very important to me. It came from a great Russian physiologist, of all people, Ivan Pavlov, you know, the Pavlov and the dog,
right.
The Pavlov's dog, the signal system, and all that, who remarked that the Russian people, you know, and this is, you know, he was talking in Petrograd, now St. Petersburg, in 1918, a year after the Bolshevik Revolution, when the country was torn by the Civil War and there were rivers of blood flowing and people buying into the Bolshevik idea of utopia, and this old man, you know, professor and Nobel Prize winner, saying, you know, we the Russians are kind of mostly interested in words and ideas and have very little concern for reality. And I was very struck when I first came across this. And the Soviet Union was very much sort of rested, the whole Soviet system rested on ideas and words and ideology. That was one of the two main pillars that supported the system, the second pillar being repressions or the threat of repressions. And these two pillars, repressions and ideology, or repressions and lies, sort of reinforced each other, like in an arc, in an arch. And when repressions got weakened, the ideology was pulled from under the system by Gorbachev's reforms, the system came crashing down. So words played extraordinarily important role in bringing the Soviet Union to its end. The Soviet Union, if you will, emerged by the word because of the idea of Lenin's and utopia and Marx, and it vanished by the word when the country ran not just out of money, it ran out of words, it ran out of ideas. And then the images and ideas became really played a crucial role in Russia's transition to capitalism. It's a quite extraordinary and hard to believe that in the late, I think it was 1990, Russia didn't officially have a capitalist system yet. There were no entrepreneurs. Commercial activity was still banned by the law. You couldn't trade money on the street. You could be arrested for that. But Russia already had a capitalist newspaper, the first capitalist newspaper which fashioned itself upon the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, a newspaper called Kommersant, which was run by the Young Turks, you know, young guys who came on the scene on the wave of Gorbachev's perestroika, who started to fashion a new country, the country that didn't exist yet. And they were describing it as if Russia was already sort of in a developed stage of capitalism. And that was extraordinary exercise in programming the future country. So, and then, of course, the role of television in the 1990s, which we talked a little bit about. So that's why I thought actually looking at Russia's history over the past 25 years through the prism of the media and television would perhaps help to understand how we got from those sort of days of promise and optimism, the heydays of perestroika and glasnost in 1980s, to today's Russia, which is seen, unfortunately, rightly, as a genuine security threat in Europe, as a threat to its own people, and as a challenge to the United States.
Well, and we do get that history in Arkady Ostrovsky's book, The Invention of Russia, From Gorbachev's Freedom to Putin's War. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the emergence of Russia from the wreckage of the Soviet Union and what has happened since. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So take us back a bit. I mean, it's hard to imagine life in the USSR, especially when you share Andrei Sakharov's writing about the death of Stalin in 1953. How did he react, and how typical was that?
The country, yes, and you're right. So the story, you know, the story of, and my the narrative of the book starts in 1953 with the death of Stalin, because the death of Stalin really divided the history of the Soviet Union into two different countries. The country, you know, under Stalin and after Stalin was two very different places because of the threat, you know, because of the death sentence which hung over everyone in the country, regardless of what you did, completely random. In that sense, you know, Stalin sort of adopted this line from the Bible, which he knew well as the preacher's son, you know, God moves in mysterious ways. And he punished in mysterious ways, and he unleashed terror in mysterious ways. You could be a member of the Communist Party, you could be loyal, or you could be, you know, an opponent, and yet, you know, you were, you could become a subject of terror and repression regardless of what you did. And Stalin kept the whole country spellbound. I mean, it was reading the accounts of the people, and Andrei Sakharov, as you say, was you know, wrote to his wife at the time, walking through Moscow in on the 5th of March 1953, when Stalin died, that he was spellbound as well by the death of a great man, impressed by his humanity. I mean, it's unbelievable that somebody as discerning, as clever, as decent as Sakharov could also succumb to this complete madness. You know, Stalin was God. And on the 5th of March, God and the devil, I mean, to me, he was a devil. You know, on the 5th of March, he was gone in 1953, and people started to breathe a little lighter, started to look around, still, with, if you imagine, sort of the image of sort of people still with ropes around their necks, who could be hung any time before that, suddenly realized that it was okay. They were alive. There was one big difference. You know, they were not to be. They were not about to be executed, and that allowed for a new generation to come on the scene. The generation of Gorbachev, those who were born in 1930, who were like Gorbachev in the early or mid-20s when Stalin died, and when Nikita Khrushchev, the man who succeeded him, gave the famous secret speech at the 20th Congress of the Communist Party denouncing Stalin's cult of personality. And Gorbachev was, the speech was kept secret, and Gorbachev and some of the characters described in my book who later took control over the media were the young communists who were charged with spreading the word amongst the rank and file of the Communist Party. The speech itself, remarkably, was not printed until, I think, 1990 or 1991. It was still kept secret. I still don't know why, by the way. I think the Soviets had extraordinary respect for, you know, communism was sort of a pseudo-religion, really, and just the same way as you spread God's word, you know, in a spoken form in the church. In the communist church, it was perhaps more of, they thought it would be more effective to spread the word rather than to simply read it. But anyway, there we are, you know, this is this generation coming of age, coming to, you know, believing still in the ideas, and this is very important. You know, you would have thought that after what Khrushchev revealed about the number of deaths and the terror that, that Stalin unleashed on the country, people would turn away from it, saying, well, the whole thing is flawed. No, not at all. On the contrary, you know, for Gorbachev's generation, the denunciation of Stalin was an affirmation, was a proof that socialism was a human and living system and which was capable of correcting its mistakes, correcting, you know, which was capable of admitting to the things that it's done. And what's very important is a lot of this man who came to do perestroika in the late 1980s, the so-called man of the 60s generation, a lot of them were the children of the old Bolsheviks. This is very important because they had this sense of responsibility before their fathers, most of whom had vanished in Stalin's gulag, in Stalin's prison camps. And so they had this complex of, you know, I call it sort of Hamlet's complex. They thought it was their duty, and they were, you know, the princes, like Hamlet was. They were the Soviet princes, they were the Soviet aristocracy. They felt it was their responsibility by the right of their birth before their fathers to carry on the tasks and the ideals with which their fathers came to establish the Bolshevik country in 1917. And they saw Stalinism as a distortion which they had to clear the system of. And a lot of their hopes got bashed in 1968 when the Soviet Union invaded Czechoslovakia, which was an example of a country of socialism trying to reform itself, trying to build something which was called socialism with a human face. When the Soviet tanks rolled into Prague and effectively threatened, you know, this were tanks against ideas, tanks against reforms, this generation got very disillusioned, including Gorbachev himself, of course, whose best friend at university was a man by the name of Zdeněk Mlynář, who was a Czech communist, a Czech reformer. A lot of these Czech reformers were brought to Moscow in handcuffs because the Soviet Union felt threatened by those reforms. And so 68 was a real sort of turning point for this man. And they waited then for 18 years for Gorbachev to come to power, for 18 years of new frosts, of new stagnation, of a sort of intensified Cold War with America. They waited for 18 years for Gorbachev to come to power to go back in history to that point in 1968 where they believed the country had gone on the wrong track. It is one of the traits of Russian modern history, and not so modern, that Russian thinkers often think of history as a track which can be traveled upon forwards or backwards. And all you need to do is to find that magical point in the road, that fork in the road, where the country has gone on the wrong track. So the problem was that in the 1980s, instead of observing reality and paying attention to facts, as Pavlov suggested, they went back to the past, to the 1968, and started from the point where the country's gone wrong.
And tried to redo it in a different way. The book is called The Invention of Russia, From Gorbachev's Freedom to Putin's War. Arkady Ostrovsky is a Russian-born journalist who works for English publications now. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return to this discussion in a minute 25. Final segment on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Arkady Ostrovsky. He's the author of the book, The Invention of Russia, From Gorbachev's Freedom to Putin's War, which just 3 weeks ago won the Orwell Prize for Best Political Writing in Book Form in England this year. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org as we talk about how the shiny baby that emerged from the wreckage of the Soviet Union turned into a rather scabby adolescent in the view of the world. Let's talk to Maggie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, Jeff. Nice to talk to you. And Mr. Ostrovsky, I am really enjoying this segment. And I just wanted to say that I'm not that much of a student of Soviet history, but you have made it sound so intriguing and so interesting that I'm going to go see if I can find your book today to read it. And I'm not going to be able to finish the, listening to the show because I have to turn off right now, but I'm going to tune back in tonight to get the last segment. And I just wanted to say it's been so enjoyable listening.
All right. Thanks for that, Maggie. Very much appreciate it. Arkady, let's do some side-by-side comparisons of Putin's Russia with perhaps the latter years of Stalin's USSR, just in terms of control of the media and fear that an individual has of the state. How do you compare those two cultures?
Jeff, I think, these are two very different countries, clearly. And I think it would be completely disrespectful to the some 20 million of people who died in Stalin's gulag and who've been executed by the Stalin's regime. Putin is not Stalin. Russia today is not Stalin's Soviet Union. And if, you know, yes, there are portraits of Stalin today in Russia, and the, you know, the modern Russian ideology adapted some of Stalin's rhetoric and imagery, but so far, thank God, Russia has not been a country of mass terror and great repression. Putin, for all his faults, is not a bloodthirsty tyrant. I know sometimes it's hard to believe that. I don't think he minds very much when some people get killed. But he is not into mass terror. Just like the late Soviet KGB, where he effectively grew up, which produced him, the late Soviet KGB in the 70s was not Stalin's NKVD. It was about control, not about repression. And Putin controls, you know, Putin had not staged, the kind of acts as we saw in China in 1989 in Tiananmen Square. Putin deals with discontent or tries to control people
people in his country by mostly two means. The two main tools is bribes, you know, money, and the other is sort of manipulation through the media. And now there is, yes, there is more repression now than there was before because there is less money. And there is more manipulation through the media and playing with people's minds and playing to some of their instincts. Now, the first of those, the money, obviously has been incredibly important in Putin's popularity and control and consolidation of power. Russian economy started to grow. He was incredibly lucky. Russian economy started to grow just as he came to power in 1999. Then the oil price started to rise. Russia pocketed billions of dollars in oil revenues, which did trickle down, which fueled an enormous consumption boom in Russia. And the social contract was, okay, you can get rich, you can spend money, you can enjoy life, sit in coffee shops, sip your cappuccinos, travel to Turkey or Greece on holidays, but just stay out of politics. Leave politics to us. And people very readily agreed to that deal. Until such a time when the income stopped growing, the oil price stopped growing, the economy started to stagnate and then to shrink. And then people started asking questions. What about, we now have all this money, we have feature comforts, we have the same iPhones, the same iPads, we go on holidays, but we still have very old-fashioned state, which doesn't grant any dignity to people, which still humiliates them. So we want a modern nation state. And we want, by the way, some political representation. And that was the subject of the protests in Moscow in 2011-2012. You may remember those crowds of middle-class Muscovites and people in other cities, which ended with sort of people chanting "Russia without Putin." And Putin responded to that not again with mass terror, with a Tiananmen-like shooting, but he responded to that with an idea which was more powerful than it turned out to be more powerful, at least in the short term, than the idea of modernization and the idea of the nation state, of a modern European nation state. He deployed the idea, centuries old idea of imperial nationalism, which yes was very prevalent in Stalin's years, because Stalin was an emperor, really. He was Tsar. He did very easily away with these sort of Bolsheviks' ideas of global world revolution and internationalism and all that. So Putin responded with that idea, and that idea culminated in the annexation of Crimea, which was immensely popular. So Putin is a very ideological man in that regard, and he uses the media, which created the narrative for the annexation of Crimea and for the war in eastern Ukraine, to then perform those actions. So the media came first, the idea and the narrative came first, and the narrative was one of Ukrainian fascists seizing power, threatening lives of Russian speakers, which was complete lies. And then the army came to sort of play it out on the ground, if you like. But is he like Stalin? No, he's not. Stalin is seen in Russia today as a symbol of a great state. Putin is a statist at heart. I mean, that is his probably biggest belief. He believes in the state, he believes in the big state, and he believes in the power of the state over the people, which is something that, if you talk about the biggest change from Gorbachev to Putin, Gorbachev came with the idea that human life was superior to anything else, was superior to the interests of the state. Putin reversed it back. The interests of the state are now superior to the interests and the rights of an individual. But I think it would be still wrong to draw complete parallels with Stalin. We still have a long way to go, and I hope Russia never really embarks on that road.
Arkady Ostrovsky is our guest on The Exchange. His book is The Invention of Russia, From Gorbachev's Freedom to Putin's War. So what kind of hope do you hold out that that someone will challenge Putin, or is it more like waiting for Putin to get bored and step off the scene, maybe in another 8 years or so, and somebody to succeed him?
I think waiting for Putin to be bored is going to be a very long wait. I think people who are sort of hooked on that kind of power, and Putin is in the position of the Tsar, don't just get bored. Also, don't forget, Putin and his friends from security services accumulated enormous amount of wealth, most of it illegitimately, and they have to protect it. So they're not going to step aside. It's too dangerous. And after what they've done in stealing another country's territory, and after what they've done in Ukraine, it's kind of too late. They will hang on to power for as long as possible, and they will not leave power until they are absolutely sure that they themselves and their children are physically secure. So I expect Putin to stay in power for some time. Now, in the longer term, you know what I believe in is that you can't stop the progression of history. You can't stop generational shifts, and Russia moves by generations, just like Gorbachev's generation that came of age after Stalin's death performed perestroika, just like their sons tried to build capitalism, albeit a very flawed one, completely deprived of any idea of morals and honesty. There will come, and already is coming, in the next generation of people who were born, you know, as you said in your introduction, 25 years have passed since the collapse of the Soviet Union. A new generation has been born. Unfortunately, they live effectively all their lives under, or sort of their adult lives under Putin. But I think that their aspirations and the kind of demands that we saw 5 years ago in Moscow are not going to disappear. And Russia doesn't have a repression mechanism of Stalin's order. And I think eventually, having gone through this period of restoration or revisionism, I still hope that Russia will, the pendulum will swing back, that Russia will go back to the idea of a nation state friendly to the West, sharing European values, you know, that it will follow the same path as we've seen in Ukraine. Now, this may be too optimistic. There is a darker possibility, which is that the KGB has already screwed up one country that was called the Soviet Union. They're screwing another one, and that this country will not be able to withstand all the pressures. And the country, which we know as Russian Federation, which is anything but federation at the moment, which is a very centralized state, will simply start to crumble, and we'll have to deal with another process of a disintegration, which we're no more ready for than we were 25 years ago.
An email here from Marty, no town given. I remember seeing an episode of Frontline some time ago that described Putin's early role in the protection of the mayor of St. Petersburg during corruption investigations. Yeltsin noticed his effectiveness as possibly being helpful in the same way to his corruption problems. Is this an accurate take on Putin's selection as the leader of Russia?
Yes, it is. Completely. I think Putin was rewarded. Yeltsin looked around his entourage. He saw Putin, who on the one hand was a security guy, on the other hand was very helpful to the former mayor of St. Petersburg, Anatoly Sobchak, stayed loyal to him during those investigations. Yeltsin himself was not corrupt, but the family, his immediate family, his extended family, the oligarchs obviously were. And so they saw Putin as I said, the guy who would be obedient, who would be loyal, and who will ensure that they can hold on to their hold on to their riches and positions.
Is the average Russian feeling a great deal more pride than they felt in the latter days of the Soviet Union? I mean, that you've mentioned that Putin is popular. There's the nationalistic feelings that he plays to with the takeover of the Crimea, for example. I mean, are the average Russians fairly happy with Putin?
Yeah, so far. I mean, it's always hard to say in a country with no competitive media and no competitive politics whether somebody, you know, how popular someone really is. You know, what do you measure? I mean, there is always a degree of fear of telling, you know, the pollsters what you think. People are obviously influenced by television, which the state has complete monopoly over. So are we actually measuring popularity, or are we measuring simply the viewing figures of the state television? You know, a bit hard to say. But no, I mean, on the whole, he remains popular exactly because he, in the perception of the majority of Russian people, he made Russia great again. And this greatness, and this is the sad part, this greatness is measured not in GDP per capita or wealth or health. It's measured in the number of bombs dropped on Syria or amount of territory seized in Ukraine.
Oh, an imperialist sort of view of things. The book is called The Invention of Russia, From Gorbachev's Freedom to Putin's War. Arkady Ostrovsky, who's a Russian-born journalist, wrote it and won the Orwell Prize in England for Best Political Writing. Thank you so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, take care.